This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carol Van Dam, and here's what's coming up.
We have been working very closely this past year with the DRC and other affected country governments, as well as regional and global health partners, to monitor and respond to the growing number of the Clade 1 mpox.
That was John Hengesong, the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and Senior Bureau Official for Global Health Security and Diplomacy, on U.S. efforts to contain the spread of mpox in Africa. Also, the World Health Organization says nearly half of the deaths among children under age 5 are linked to underage. And the U.S. military says it has completed its withdrawal from Niger. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The United States has committed billions of dollars to support the global response to the Clade 1 mpox outbreak, which is spreading across the Democratic Republic of the Congo and other African countries. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
John Nkengasong is the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and Senior Bureau Official for Global Health Security and Diplomacy. During an online news briefing Monday, he said the U.S. administration has been closely monitoring the spread of mpox, specifically Clade 1 mpox.
Over the last year, in 2023, the United States allocated more than $2.65 billion in bilateral health funding to countries in Central and East Africa, more than any other donor. We have been working very closely this past year with the DRC and other affected country governments, as well as regional and global health partners, to monitor and respond to the growing number of the Clade 1 mpox cases.
Last week, the United States delivered 50,000 doses of mpox vaccines to the Democratic Republic of Congo as part of a response plan to mitigate the outbreak. The United States was the first nation to commit to a donation of vaccines. Nkengasong gave more details.
And we're also providing financial support for the rollout of the vaccine doses. Along with donations from the European Union and the manufacturers, more than 250,000 doses have been delivered to DRC in the last 2 weeks alone. The United States support also includes testing, genetic sequencing, laboratory training, health workforce surveillance, and infection control and prevention.
The U.S. government also donated vaccines to Nigeria.
As this outbreak continues, we are monitoring it very, very closely. It's a question of working collaboratively with WHO, Africa CDC, and other partners to bring this outbreak to a closure. We cannot live with mpox circulating. So regardless of where the virus occurs, we will continue to use our existing investments in global health security assets to support countries to respond.
The European Union so far has sent about 200,000 doses of the vaccine to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Since the beginning of the outbreak in late 2023, United States Agency for International Development and the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have supported the DRC government with coordination and funding for an initial response plan. Since March, USAID and CDC have provided 20 million doses to support Clade 1 mpox response efforts in Central and Eastern Africa. In August, USAID pledged up to an additional $35 million in emergency health assistance to bolster response efforts. Last month, the World Health Organization declared a public health emergency of international concern because of the surge of mpox cases. The Clade 1 variant is of particular concern now because it appears to cause more serious illness. Mpox cases recently have been confirmed in several countries, including Burundi, Rwanda, Uganda, Kenya, and South Africa. Cases also have been found recently in Sweden and Thailand. The patients had recently traveled to Africa. Previously known as monkeypox, the mpox virus is transmitted from animals to humans, with cases often found close to tropical rainforests. The disease can spread from human to human through close physical contact and can be fatal in some cases. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
More than 400 million children around the world are not getting the nutrients they need to grow and thrive. The World Health Organization says nearly half of the deaths among children under the five-year age mark are linked to undernutrition. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has released the 2024 Goalkeepers Report titled A Race to Nourish a Warming World, which emphasizes the devastating burden of malnutrition and explores innovative ways to tackle the crisis. In an exclusive interview, Bill Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, tells VOA's Lenore Moudou why the issue of malnutrition needs more attention and resources.
When most people hear the word malnutrition, they'll think of situations where there's a food shortage, an extreme food shortage, like a famine. And although that does happen and it's tragic, that's not the main case for malnutrition. Malnutrition's happening where some kid doesn't get the right diet, gets some diarrheal episode, and their gut, including the microbiome part of their gut, is inflamed, and so they're not able to take advantage of the food. And so with our African scientists, we looked at twins where one twin would do well and one wouldn't, and then, you know, took samples to understand, okay, exactly what's going on and how do you stop that? And so it's partly micronutrients that are missing, things like iron, zinc, vitamin A. It's partly a lack of protein. And so we have a variety of ways of intervening, some of which are very inexpensive. You know, of course, a critical period for nutrition, before you're born, your mother's nutrition affects your entire life, you know, how your brain and body develops. And so one of the exciting new interventions is giving pregnant mothers additional vitamins. You know, we've always traditionally given them two, iron and folic acid, but by adding four others, which is only a few dollars per pregnancy, we see that the health of the mother and the health of the baby are substantially improved.
Some of these interventions, as you mentioned, are being implemented right now. It's a big problem on a big scale. What else is needed?
The challenges, you know, whether it's malnutrition or malaria, they're not quite as visible to the entire world that should pitch in as it should be. And particularly right now, you know, where the world's very focused on, you know, we've got a war in Ukraine, we've got unrest in the Middle East, the focus on helping the continent where, you know, there's the most young people and the most growth and therefore the most potential, I'd say that's quite a bit down from where we were before the pandemic. And we see that not just in understanding the health issues, but, you know, helping out with the debts and the debt payments that many African countries have, or even the aid levels. You know, aid to Africa is the lowest portion of aid that it's been in history. You know, one topic people do pay attention to is climate change. And so, you know, there's an important connection in the report where we say, you know, if you feel bad about climate change, what should you do? Well, these nutritional interventions are the highest impact thing to help the adaptation to minimize the damage. And that area of climate adaptation doesn't get enough effort. And then given that resources are so limited, what are the things that should be done to help these children? You know, that's the human lens that we need to apply to, you know, if I care about climate change, what am I doing to help?
That is Bill Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He was speaking with my colleague Lenore Moudou from Seattle. The U.S. military said on Monday it has completed its withdrawal from Niger, meeting a demand from coup leaders in the African country. The military juntas in the Sahel region have kicked out French and U.S. troops and U.N. peacekeepers. The Russia Wagner Group has capitalized on the absence of foreign involvement to expand their influence by protecting African coup leaders and fighting jihadists. Ambassador J. Peter Pham, former U.S. Special Envoy to the Sahel, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi how serious the involvement of Russian mercenaries are in the Sahel as of now.
I think we have to unpack several things. First is an acknowledgement that the coups occurred and have large, widespread popular support precisely because, as you mentioned, not only did the governments that preceded the elected governments were ineffective and in some cases corrupt, but also the international intervention was not fit for purpose. In particular, that is the case of the 10-year-old mission of the former UN peacekeeping mission in Mali, MINUSMA, which quite frankly was not fit for purpose. It was more designed to help the French military intervention than to actually provide security and peacekeeping because there was no peace to keep. In fact, that's one of the reasons why when I was in government, I pushed for a strategic review of that mission. So, you know, one has to acknowledge the reality that set this context. On the other hand, while this reality has given the opportunity for forces like the so-called Wagner Group, or now it's been rebranded the Africa Corps from Russia, to enter into the scene, whether they are effective or not is very much in doubt. The defeat by ambush, Wagner, as well as Malian troops at the very end of July near the Algerian border, underscored the fact that although they've proven good, the Russian mercenaries, at killing civilians and gold mining, their effectiveness as a counterterrorism force leaves a lot to be desired. And in fact, they lost a number they could very ill afford to lose at the time.
The continuing collapse of international counterterrorism support, as well as weakening leadership in regional efforts, has created a vacuum in which violent extremism was unable to expand, and the persistent and growing strength of violent extremist organizations in the Sahel threatens to exacerbate the humanitarian crisis and spread instability across Africa, posing significant security and financial risks to the United States and Europe. What needs now to be done to safeguard stability in the region?
Well, this is a region that has long been under stress, economic, developmental, governance, and stress brought about by climatic change. And now we have this threat of violent extremism throughout the region, and it's a growing threat. To be remembered that more than half of all victims of terrorism last year were in this region of Africa. That, you know, underscores how important it is and how it's necessary to focus attention on it, even as we have numerous other crises around the world. And we're seeing these extremists spread from the Sahel out to the coastal states of West Africa, endangering those countries as well as economic interests in those countries, and potentially causing more migrants to flow toward Europe's southern flank. So this is a problem that really deserves a global approach to dealing with it. That being said, however, that attention has not been consistent, and the international community needs, and especially the United States and its European partners, to be pragmatic about this, to not be doctrinaire. Lectures solve nothing. What we need to do is figure a way to work with the governments in place, not condoning coups, but working with reality, as well as the fact that these governments, these regimes in place, do for now enjoy popular support.
That was Ambassador J. Peter Pham, former U.S. Special Envoy to the Sahel. He was speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi. Mali's army, meanwhile, said today that the situation was under control there after what it called a foiled infiltration attempt by militants into a military police base in the capital, Bamako, where attacks are rare. Mali said the capital was under control after the attack was repelled. An al-Qaeda affiliate known as Jamaz Nusra al-Uslam wa al-Muslimin claimed responsibility for that attack. Mali has been ruled by a military junta since back-to-back coups in 2020 and a year later. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com, and there you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam, in Washington, and we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. When Kamala Harris and Donald Trump faced each other on the debate stage just less than 2 months before Election Day, the two candidates were at odds on issues ranging from the economy to tariffs and the Ukraine. But on immigration, their positions were especially different. VOA's immigration reporter Aline Barras has the story.
Immigration was a big topic during the first presidential debate. While Vice President Kamala Harris didn't answer a question about the increased numbers of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border, former President Donald Trump repeated his false claims about migrants and crime.
Millions of people let in, and all over the world, crime is down all over the world except here.
Research shows immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than the U.S.-born people. But at his rallies, Trump maintains his hard line on immigration, promising to build on his previous efforts if reelected.
If I win on day one, we will begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
Immigration experts have questions. Here's David Desigard Kalik. He's the director of the Immigration Research Initiative.
What exactly are we talking about here? Is it, are there going to be police and immigration officers showing up at everyone's door and asking to see their papers?
When Harris was asked about illegal crossings at the border, which surged under the Biden administration before falling back in recent months, she shifted the blame to Trump, noting he had Republicans in Congress kill a bipartisan immigration reform bill.
And let me say that the United States Congress, including some of the most conservative members of the United States Senate, came up with a border security bill, which I supported. And that bill would have put 1,500 more border agents on the border.
Experts stress that without action from Congress, real immigration reform is out of reach. Here's Kalik again.
One of them talked about the importance of Congress, and I feel like there's only, the president makes a huge difference, and we would, there's a lot a president can do, but there also are limits to what a president can do.
At an Arizona rally, Harris reminded the crowd that as president, she would sign an immigration bill.
We know our immigration system is broken, and we know what it takes to fix it. Comprehensive reform that includes strong border security and an earned pathway to citizenship.
It is unlikely Harris and Trump will share the debate stage again. Voters will need to follow their immigration plans closely as they continue on the campaign trail. Aline Barros, VOA News, Washington.
Despite global efforts to stop the practice of female genital mutilation, the harmful tradition continues to affect the lives and health of millions of women and girls in Somalia. Reporter Najib Ahmed has this report from the capital Mogadishu, narrated by Anthony Labruto.
This 17-year-old girl lives with her family in a camp for the internally displaced in Mogadishu. She says she is the victim of female genital mutilation, or FGM, a harmful traditional practice defined by the World Health Organization as the partial or total removal of the external female genitalia for non-medical reasons. Since the procedure at 12 years old, she has lived with persistent pain, health problems, and emotional trauma. She chose to speak to VOA anonymously because she fears backlash for speaking about a taboo topic.
I went through a lot of pain, lost a lot of blood because of excessive bleeding, and suffered from recurring infections, which still gives me nightmares. I hope my sisters will not undergo the pain I went through.
FGM persists in Somalia because of the common belief that uncut girls and women are promiscuous, unclean, and physically undesirable. The United Nations says that 98% of Somali girls and women ages 15 to 49 have undergone some form of FGM. Midwife Shamsa Ali Mohammed performed FGM for over 20 years, but now she is one of the many women fighting to end the practice, which she calls circumcision. The United Nations Population Fund, or UNFPA, discourages the use of the term, pointing out that female circumcision is a violation of human rights and a much different procedure from male circumcision. Here's Shamsa Ali Mohammed.
We used to circumcise a lot of girls, but we have now stopped the practice since IFRA Foundation trained us. We now raise awareness against FGM as it hurts women and girls, and many are suffering during labor because of this harmful practice.
IFRA Foundation is a nonprofit working to end FGM in Somalia. Its founder, Somali-Irish social activist IFRA Mohammed, says her organization's engagement have persuaded hundreds of people to pledge not to practice any form of FGM.
I don't want people to see me just interfering to the community. So we trained all the leaders, religious leaders, women's group authorities in districts. So we allowed them to start the conversation and build the dialogue about female genital mutilation.
Another organization, SASA Together, aims to mobilize the community and also aims to abolish FGM. Mohammed Mursal is a UNFPA program specialist who works with SASA Together.
As an organization, we are fighting to eradicate FGM in Somalia by closely working with the government of Somalia, especially the Minister of Family Affairs, to come up with a legal framework that criminalizes FGM in Somalia.
Although the Somali constitution prohibits FGM and describes it as cruel and degrading, no national law exists that criminalizes the practice. Anti-FGM activists say that unless that happens, girls and women will continue to suffer. For Najib Ahmed in Mogadishu, Somalia, Anthony Labruto, VOA News.
10 civilians were killed in a midnight attack by the Kodeko militia on a village in eastern Democratic Republic of Congo's Ituri province, the head of local administration and a civil society leader said on today. Reuters News reports that fighters of the armed group entered a village in the Junga territory, where the majority of residents are from the Hema community. Authorities say the fighters killed 10 people in two households. An official told Reuters that attackers cut off the heads of some of the victims and cut open their bodies. The Kodeko is one of a myriad of militias fighting over land and resources in East Congo. The United Nations has accused it of committing attacks against other communities, including Hema herders, that could constitute war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Hello! This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
And that wraps it up for us, this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Vandy, and our engineer, Atreus Regis, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.